and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan and around the region this Monday, November 6th, 2023. Another deadly cattle raid attack, this time in Jungle State.
Some youth came and attacked by this fire, and then they went away with the cattle, and by this youth tried to recover the cattle back.
And activists warn President Clear to rethink who is sitting on the National Elections Commission.
They need to subject the names for a vetting process that would clean away the party identity, but focus on their competence and their ability to deliver. And I think that would be positive for the country.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. First, our top story. More than 20 people were killed and several others wounded yesterday after a shell hit a market in Omdurman near Sudan's capital, Khartoum. It's the latest deadly attack in the ongoing fighting between forces loyal to Army Chief Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, head of the paramilitary rapid support forces, and the Sudanese army led by Abdel Fattah el-Burhan. VOA's Paul Ndiho reports.
The bustling market in Omdurman was struck by shells following intense exchange between the Sudanese army and the RSF on Sunday. A group of lawyers expressed deep concern and strongly condemned the fighting between the two factions in densely populated areas. The conflict in Sudan between the regular army and the paramilitary rapid support force is in its seventh month, with no signs of abating. The death toll over the 6 months of fighting has been devastating for the country, with more than 10,000 casualties, according to an estimate by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data. 5.6 million people have been displaced or have become refugees in neighboring countries. The impact on Khartoum is immense, with widespread destruction and political fragmentation among supporters of the two military commanders fighting for control of the country. To address the ongoing conflict, Sudan's army has agreed to send a delegation for talks with the RSF to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in a bid to achieve at least a temporary halt to the fighting. The power struggle over the terms for a gradual transition from military to civilian rule is not only devastating to Khartoum, but it has also led to ethnically driven attacks in parts of Darfur in western Sudan. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
Authorities in South Sudan's Jungle State say 8 people were killed and 3 others wounded in a cattle raid over the weekend. A Jungle State official says the attackers are suspected of coming from the Greater Pibor administrative area. The information minister in Greater Pibor neither denies nor admits armed young men from his area carried out the attack. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
The Jonglei State Information Minister, Nyadak John, says armed assailants suspected of crossing into the state from neighboring Greater Pibor administrative area attacked a cattle camp in Baidit Payam of Bor County in Jonglei State on Saturday afternoon.
Some youth came and attacked by this fire, and then they went away with the cattle, and by this youth tried to recover the cattle back, and then it was not that easy between the both sides. And then the war broke out, and there were even casualties. They killed 3 people, and then they wounded 7 people. 4 of them were in critical condition.
Kur Ayuen, a youth leader in Bor County, says armed young men from Baidit pursued and clashed with the attackers, killing all of them.
The attackers were comprehensively handled. 5 of them were eliminated. In our official statement, we have put 4, but we later discovered the 5th person. So the 5 attackers were completely disabled, and there are no more. We had 3 people were killed on the site of Bor Council. The 5 assailants were all killed.
Ayuen confirms several people were injured in the attack and are receiving treatment.
As we speak, we have 3 people from Bor County that were wounded. We are nursing their injuries. They are being treated now in Juba. we have to do an evacuation, an emergency evacuation, because of the heaviness of their situation.
Abraham Kelang, Information Minister for the Greater Pibor Administrative Area, would not confirm or deny that gunmen from his area carried out the attack. Kelang did say authorities in Jonglei and Greater Pibor are working to promote peace and end deadly cattle raids in the area.
We are working hard, and we are working hand to hand to solve these problems or any cattle raiding or attackers like what is happening in Baidit. Currently, the delegate from Bor and Lonwer Murle is currently staying in Ayot County.
For several decades, cattle raiding attacks have been common in parts of eastern Equatoria and Jonglei states, as well as the Greater Pibor Administrative Area, but the raids have become more deadly in recent times after communities acquired modern automatic rifles. Several agreements signed by leaders of the communities in recent years have not resolved the problem. For VOA News, I'm Charlton Doki in Juba.
Civil society organizations in South Sudan are expressing concern about the composition of the reconstituted National Elections Commission. One activist notes that all members of the reconstituted Elections Commission have political affiliations, something she says will compromise the outcome of the 2024 elections. Manyang David Mayar has more for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir last Friday reconstituted three independent bodies necessary for conducting next year's elections: the National Constitutional Review Commission, the National Elections Commission, and the Political Parties Council. But civil society activists say all 58 officials appointed to the reconstituted commissions are either affiliated to the SPLM in government, SPLM in opposition, the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, or other political parties and other stakeholders. President Kiir appointed Abednego Akuo-Katchwal, who is affiliated with the SPLMRG, as the chairperson of the National Election Commission, which worries some civil society activists who think having an in-government party official run the commission may tarnish the 2024 elections. Lona Merikaje, Secretary General of the South Sudan Democratic Engagement Monitoring and Observation Program, says members of the National Elections Commission should be people who have no political affiliation in the country.
Initially, the suggestion was that when reconstituting these commissions, there is need to subject the names for a vetting process. That would clean away the party identity, but focus on their competence and their ability to deliver. And I think that would be positive for the country. Making it to be heavily with party identity, I think it has lost the meaning. We have missed the point again.
Merikaje says having commission members with party affiliations will complicate the electoral process in South Sudan. Terma Nyangadwich, executive director of the Center for Peace and Advocacy, says the newly appointed chairperson of the National Elections Commission is seen as an ally of President Kiir's ruling SPLM party, and therefore he should not lead the electoral body. He calls on the government to learn from the region and appoint non-partisan people into the commission in order to be transparent.
Because Professor Abednego is directly involved in the SPLM, which will compromise the outcome of the elections in 2024. However, the President Kiir should reappoint a person that does not have the political affiliation, you know, in order for citizens to accept the outcome of the election.
Gadwich says members of the National Elections Commission should be impartial and harsh Kiir to learn from the region on how to form the commission. Activist Jacqueline Nasiwa says political representation on the National Election Commission will only create chaos.
Having this institution filled with political parties is likely to be problematic in terms of keeping their neutrality and impartiality, because we know our history with the party arrangements is that they always take side of their party, and it will be still a space where parties will be pulling the rope.
Nasiwa says she's also concerned that the 35% women representation in public institutions stipulated in the peace deal has been violated, as the 9-member commission only has 2 women. Government spokesperson and information minister Michael Makwe denies the chair of the National Election Commission, Abednego Akuk, is a member of the ruling SPLM party.
Who told them that the chairman of the election commission is a partisan? Do they have the proof that he is a registered member of the SPLM and that he is actively involved in SPLM politics? He was the chairman of the election commission, that election which was done in 2010, and he continues to be the chair. Where does the problem come in?
Makwe insists that the appointment of the current leadership and members of the National Election Commission was agreed to by all stakeholders of the 2018 peace agreement. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, why is former U.S. President Donald Trump, the current GOP presidential frontrunner, likely to take the witness stand today? Stay tuned.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Purdue University professor, Ethiopian-born scientist Gabista Ejeta, is acclaimed as one of the world's leading plant geneticists and recently received the National Medal of Science, the highest state honor attainable by scientists in the U.S. He specializes in the study of sorghum, a popular source of food in Africa and the second most important cereal on the continent. It's been embraced as a staple by several African countries, particularly those prone to drought. He tells Africa News Tonight host Yahyes Wuhib that his childhood experience of drought and hunger strongly influenced his scientific research over the years, fueling him to improve food security.
I had a very simple life. I was born and raised in a small rural community in west central Ethiopia. My parents were poor, and as such, it's not a complicated life. I was raised by a single mother, and as such, the responsibility for my mother to raise me and provide me with all the provisions I need for a proper nutrition and growth is compromised as a result of the poverty that was surrounding us. Hunger is a constant as a child, and just going to school in an empty stomach and, of course, rushing for lunch and so on. But as a result, I have seen hunger and challenges that poverty in our communities in Ethiopia usually surface. And so that's what I'm talking about. As such, I have become sensitive to the needs of the poor because of the surroundings that I grew up with.
So, Professor, you are acclaimed as one of the world's leading plant geneticists. You were given the award, Outstanding Contribution to the Science of Plant Genetics. What, in simple terms, is the science of plant genetics?
The plant genetics is a study of trait inheritance, you know, how human geneticists study about relationship between families and so on, and look into genes that express particular traits. And in plant genetics, we're studying crop plants, plants in general. And in my case, I was studying crop plant. And the crop I studied was sorghum. I've stayed with it from the beginning till the end, and therefore developed an understanding about the genetics or the traits of these crops and manipulating that for efficiency and productivity and disease control and tolerance to drought and parasitic weeds is the kind of research that I had done. So in simple terms, it's how to improve traits of crop plants to make them behave differently than they normally do. And that's what the science of genetics is all about in general.
So sorghum is the, as I understand it, it's the fifth most important cereal crop globally after maize, wheat, rice, and barley. Talk to us a little about the development of sorghum as an hybrid that is resistant to both drought and the parasitic weed Striga, which commonly invades farms in Africa.
Sorghum is an important crop around the world because it's used for food, feed, and fuel. But it's particularly important in Africa, where the crop evolved. Historically, the crop is evolved in the eastern part of Africa. Its homeland is said to be Ethiopia and Sudan. All the way it evolved between the Nuba Mountains of Sudan to the northern highlands of Ethiopia. And the crop evolved and started there and evolved and spread to different parts of the world, first initially to Eastern and Western Africa, and eventually from there over the Indian Ocean to the India and over the Himalayas, over later on to other places like China and so on. So it's an important crop for Africa, and Africans know the crop and raise it throughout the continent, and it's very important to them. But as climate change gets severe, even crop like sorghum and millet, which are very traditionally or inherently tolerant to drought, also succumb to that. And so the gist of my research has been trying to put in genes for drought tolerance, genes for parasitic weed resistance, to develop this crop so that they can be utilized under severe stress conditions throughout the continent.
That was Purdue University professor, Ethiopian-born scientist Jabisa Ejeto, who received a National Medal of Science from U.S. President Joe Biden. He was speaking to my colleague, Yehias Wuhib. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is expected to take the witness stand today in the civil fraud trial in New York against him and his family real estate business. He's accused of deliberately inflating his property values to get better terms on loans and insurance, which is fraud. Todd Belt, professor and director of the Political Management Master's Program at George Washington University, tells me that he believes this is a publicity stunt for Trump, but a risky one.
Most lawyers would caution against someone like Donald Trump taking the stand in his own fraud trial. We saw someone like Sam Bankman-Fried just last week took the stand, and it went really poorly for him. Tremendous amount of cross-examination. But this is what's different with Trump. He will fire lawyers if he doesn't think that they're going to do what he wants. And what he wants is to explain everything away and to make himself into the victim. It's worked for him in the past, and he thinks it's going to work for him this time.
When you say explain everything away, how does he do that?
Well, there's mountains of evidence, of course, showing that the president engaged in some fraud in terms of putting the valuation of his properties higher for when he was taking loans and lower for when he was paying taxes. So there's a lot of evidence there, but he's going to try to deflect and pivot and try to make this political. His main goal when he goes on the stand is to make himself into some sort of political prisoner, as if this is some sort of political prosecution trying to get him out of the president's race.
And what about his sons? They also testified and kind of both said that they left it up to accountants, I guess, and
right.
Really didn't have a pulse on what was going on in the day-to-day operations, although they signed off on the main documents about the valuation of all these companies, right?
Donald Trump's sons certainly didn't do any sort of favors to themselves or to their father when they were on the stand. They really pretty much said, well, we left it up to the accountants, but it's their signatures that are on the bottom of those pages.
Looking around, there's a couple of other trials that he faces. Where do things stand with all the criminal trials? And do you expect him to testify on his own behalf in any of those cases?
I think what we're going to see is Donald Trump is going to see how this one goes. This is one of the ones where a lot of people believe that this, especially in the Republican Party, that this is a political prosecution rather than something that's a legal prosecution. It's not quite as clear as the case in Georgia, where he is on tape asking for election results to be changed. That one could be much more damning. At the GW University, we have our own poll, and we ask people whether or not they thought that these cases were politically motivated or not. And when we started with cases such as the civil cases like this one and the payoff to Stormy Daniels, people were more likely to say that they were politically motivated. When we talked about the January 6th trial and the voting issue in Georgia, people were less likely. So what's going to be really important is which of these trials really flow through the election cycle next year. Donald Trump likes to slow things down, and that might actually be bad for him if some of these ones that are more high profile, like the Georgia and the January 6th one, are in the public mind this time next year.
Is this more or less going to be a publicity stunt for him today?
This is absolutely a publicity stunt for Donald Trump. This is him doing what he always does, which is taking bad news and turning it into good politics, making himself into a victim, and by extension, making his voters think that the government's out to get them as well.
That is Todd Belt, professor and director of political management master's program at George Washington University. He was speaking to me in Washington here earlier today. A spokesperson for Israel's defense forces says it's a national priority to rescue and release citizens kidnapped by Hamas. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner says the ground operation, coupled with diplomatic efforts, are also continuing to ensure the release of hostages. Lerner's remarks come after local media reported Israeli families are pressuring the government to ensure the safe return of their loved ones. For more on the war between Israel and Hamas, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner via Skype.
The hostage issue is a national top priority on all levels. So there are combined efforts, both operational and diplomatic. There are currently 241 hostages being held by Hamas, Israelis and foreign nationals across a different age group from 10 months old till 88. The hostage issue is at the top of our priority. It is one of the missions of the war, of our efforts, and we are operating on the ground, at air, and at sea, and utilizing all of the tools that we have. Of course, we're able to rescue one hostage last week, and we're utilizing all of the efforts in order to bring everybody home.
Now, there are also concerns about the IDF activities, especially with the ground force that you are using, about the casualties. Talk to me about efforts to limit these casualties.
The IDF is operating based on principles of distinction, military necessity, proportionality, and weighing up the three of those components together in order to achieve our military goal. In order to conduct that, one of our main efforts in the last 3 weeks has been to evacuate people from harm's way. We've been encouraging people through text messages, through phone calls, through voice messages, through leaflets we've dropped from the sky, phoning people and encourage them to leave the combat zone. This is where Hamas is operating, in the north of the Gaza Strip, and you need to go south. It is safer in the south. There is no combat going on in the south. And that's what we've been doing. We've seen a huge shift of people. Around 1 million people or so have left the Gaza Strip, the north of the Gaza Strip, gone down south in order to get out of harm's way. We are still pursuing that effort today, even as the ground operations are ongoing and expanding. And I would say what we've seen in the last 2 days is Hamas actually trying to prevent people from going. So we saw it throughout the entire effort, but more so in the last few days. They were threatening, intimidating. They put up physical checkpoints to prevent people going south. And yesterday, when we announced that we would be opening a corridor from north to south, they actually launched RPG attack and mortar attack against the road itself, potentially putting people at risk. And we did the same today, and they did the same today. So they're trying to keep people keep them in harm's way. Of course, that is a huge challenge for any military to operate in the urban areas. And our goal is to try and limit the civilian casualties as the operation proceeds. It is an unfortunate reality of warfare, but we need to remember we did not ask for this war. We did not plan on going to war, so much so that the IDF actually failed the people of Israel, because we were working under the assumption that Hamas doesn't want to have a war with us.
Talk to me about the latest development about Israel's border with Lebanon, especially following the recent clashes there.
So Hezbollah has been escalating the confrontation on the border with Israel. We believe it's under the instructions of Iran. We've had extensive rocket fire, mortar fire, attempts to infiltrate Israel. They've used drones, sniper fire, as well as machine gun fire. So there's lots of events that have happened. We have, I think, 5 or 6 soldiers on our side that have been killed in these exchanges. And we have struck extensively against Hezbollah that have conducted these attacks against us, most of the time actually preempting their attacks. So if there's an anti-tank guided missile squad planning to launch a rocket, our efforts are to take them out before they actually conduct the launch.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, a spokesperson for Israel's Defense Forces. He was speaking in an exclusive interview with my colleague Peter Clotty. Thousands of Palestinians have been killed in the Hamas-Israel war. That wraps it up for us this Monday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Good White by Abdul Allison. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. And on behalf of our engineer, Atreus Regis, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
About 36% of women around the world work in agri-food systems, according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO. In sub-Saharan Africa, the number rises to 66%, and in South Asia, it is 71%. And increasingly, these women work off the farm. But everywhere, inequality and discrimination are creating roadblocks for women in agri-food systems. Across the globe, women typically work in worse conditions than men and for lower wages. And many countries still have inadequate legal protections for women's land ownership. Until they have the full access to and control over livestock, water, and seeds, as well as the land, technology, and the finance needed to grow their livelihoods, women cannot make a full contribution to agri-food systems, according to a recent FAO report. If women in the agri-food system had access to the same services as men, not more, just the same, we could unlock $1 trillion in gross domestic product and decrease the number of hungry people by 45 million, said USAID Feed the Future Deputy Coordinator Dina Esposito. That is why USAID announced a commitment called Generating Resilience and Opportunities for Women, or GROW.
There are 3 lines of effort. The first is focused on productivity and resilience of women farmers. And in our parlance, resilience is the ability for someone to cope, adapt, and even thrive in the face of shocks. It's about what are the capacities that already exist in a system or in a community, and how do we bolster those capacities to help people address risk.
Our commitment is to double the number of women applying improved technologies and management practices on farms, said Deputy Coordinator Esposito.
We're going to focus on access to land, higher yielding climate smart seeds and fertilizer, finance, information, and technology.
The second pillar, said Dina Esposito, is helping women improve the quality and payoff of farm jobs.
And then the third area is around really making sure that the unique needs of men and women and the gender differences of how people experience conflict is thought about as we deliver our humanitarian action.
Gender equality, said Deputy Coordinator Dina Esposito, is not just right, it's profitable, it's smart, and it's the key to building more resilient food systems.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.